went over his knees, enjoined to silence, alert to shoot anything that moved, and they were moving, silhouetted against the star-silvered river. He stopped and held Lib fast.
"Ben," he called. "Ben Franklin. Do not answer. Do not answer. This is Randy. We're on our way home."
They walked on.
"You know, you sounded just like that radio call on the Air Force frequency," Lib said.
"I did sound like that, didn't I?" He smiled in the darkness, snapped his fingers, and said, "I think I know now what was going on. It wasn't the way Sam thought. It was just the other way around. Big Rock was the plane, and Sky Queen the base. Big Rock had been somewhere and was coming home and was telling Sky Queen not to shoot, just like I told Ben Franklin."
"Perhaps you're right. Not that it matters to us. I've heard them up there on still nights, but they never come low enough to see. The Admiral hears them talk on the radio, but they never have a word for us. Maybe they've forgotten us. Maybe they've forgotten all the contaminated zones. We're unclean. It makes me feel lonely and, well, unwanted. Isn't that silly? Does it make you feel like that?"
"They'll come back," he said. "They have to. We're still a part of the United States, aren't we?"
They came to the path that led through their grove from house to dock. "Let's go out on the dock," Lib said. "I like it out there. No sound, not even the crickets. Just the river whispering around the pilings."
"All right."
They turned left instead of right. As their feet touched the planking, the ship's bell spoke. It clanged three times rapidly, then twice more. It kept on ringing.
"Oh, damn it to hell."
Randy grabbed her hand and they started the run for the house, an uphill quarter mile in sand and darkness. After 100 yards, she released his hand and fell behind. By the time he reached the back steps, Randy couldn't climb them. He was wobbling and his knees had jellied, but before the day he could not have run the distance at all. He paused, sobbing, and waited for Lib. The Model A wasn't in the driveway or the garage. He concluded that Dan hadn't returned and something frightful had happened to Helen, Peyton, or Bill McGovern. He was wrong. It had happened to Dan. Dan was in the dining room, a ruined hulk of a man overflowing the captain's chair, arms hanging loose, legs outstretched, shirt blood-soaked, beard blood-matted. Where his right eye should have been, bulged a blue-black lump large as half an apple. His nose was twisted and enlarged, his left eye only a slit and swollen, discolored flesh. "He's wrecked the car," Randy thought. He went through the windshield and his face took along the steering wheel. Helen laid a wet dish towel over Dan's eyes. Peyton, face white and pinched, stood behind her mother with another towel. It dripped. Except for Dan's choked breathing, the dripping was for a moment the only sound in the room. Dan spoke. The words came out slowly and thickly, each an effort of will.
"Was that you, Randy? Who came in?"
"It's me, Dan. Don't try to talk yet." Shock, Randy thought, and probably concussion. He turned to Helen. "We should get him into bed. We have to get him upstairs."
"I don't know if he can make it," Helen said. "We could hardly get him this far."
Helen's dress and Bill McGovern's arms were bloodstained. "Bill, with your help, I can get him up all right."
So with all his weight on their shoulders, they got Dan upstairs and stretched out on the sleigh bed. Bill said, "I'm going to be sick." He left them. Helen brought clean white towels. Dan's body shook and quivered. His skin grew clammy. He was having a chill. Randy lifted his thick wrist and after a time located the pulse. It was faint, uneven, and rapid. This was shock, all right, and dangerous. Randy said, "Whiskey." Helen said, "I'll handle this, Randy. No whiskey, blankets." He respected Helen's judgment. In an emergency such as this, Helen functioned. This was what she was made for. He found extra blankets in the closet. She covered Dan and disappeared. She returned with a glass of fluid, held it to Dan's lips, and said, "Drink this. Drink all you can." "What are you giving him?" Randy asked.
water with salt and soda, much better than whiskey for shock. Dan drank, gagged, and drank more. Keep pouring this into him, Helen ordered. I'm going to see what's in the medicine cabinet. Almost nothing, Randy said. Where's his bag? Everything's in there. They took it. And the car. Who took it? The highwaymen. He should have guessed that it hadn't been an accident. Dan was a careful driver and rarely were two cars on the same road. Traffic was no longer a problem. In his concern for Dan, he did not immediately think of what this loss meant to all of them. Helen found peroxide and bandages. This, with aspirin, was almost all that remained of their reserve medical supply. She worked on Dan's face swiftly and efficiently as a professional nurse. Randy felt nauseated. Not at the sight of Dan's injuries. He had seen worse, but in disgust at the beasts who in callous cruelty had dragged down and maimed and destroyed the human dignity of this selfless man. Yet it was nothing new. It had been like this at some point in every civilization and on every continent. There were human jackals for every human disaster. He flexed his fingers, wanting a throat in them. He walked into the other room. Lib's head lay across her arms on the bar. She was crying. When she raised her face, it was oddly twisted, as when a child's face loses form in panic or unexpected pain. She said, "What are you going to do about it, Randy?" His rage was a hard, cold ball in his stomach now. When he spoke, it was in a monotone, the voice of someone else. "I'm going to execute them. Let's get with it." "Yes, as soon as I find out who." At 11, Dan Gunn came out of shock, relaxed, and then slept for a few minutes. He awoke, announcing he was hungry. He looked no better, he was in pain, but obviously he was out of danger. Randy was dismayed at the thought of Dan and his condition loading his stomach with cold bream and catfish, orange juice, and remnants of salad. What he needed coming out of shock was hot, nourishing bouillon or broth. On occasion, when Malachi or Caleb discovered a gopher hole and Hannah Henry converted its inhabitant to soup, or when Ben Franklin successfully stalked squirrel or rabbit, such food was available, but not on this night. The thought of broth triggered his memory. He shouted, "The iron rations!" and ran into his office. He threw open the teak sea chest and began digging. Lib and Helen stood behind him and watched, perplexed. Helen said, "What's wrong with you now, Randy?" "Don't give him any food until you see what I've got." He was sure he had tucked the foil-covered carton in the corner closest to the desk. He wasn't there. He wondered whether it was something he had dreamed, but when he concentrated, it seemed very real. It had been on the day before the day, after his talk with Malachi. In the kitchen, he had collected a few nourishing odds and ends, tinned or sealed, and dubbed them iron rations for a desperate time. Now that the time was desperate, he couldn't find them. He found the carton in the fourth corner he probed. He lifted it out, tore at the foil, and exposed it for them to see. "I put it away for an emergency. I'd forgotten it." Lib whispered, "It's beautiful." She examined and fondled the jars and cans. "There's beef broth in here. Lots of other stuff." He gave up the carton. "Give him everything he wants." Dan drank the broth and chewed hard candies. Randy wanted to question him, but Helen stopped it. "Tomorrow," she said, "when he's stronger." Helen and Lib were still in the bedroom when Randy stretched out on the living room couch. Graff jumped up and nuzzled himself abed under Randy's arm, and they slept. Randy awoke with a gunshot echoing in his ears, and Graff, whining, struggling to be free of his arm. He heard a second shot. It was from the double 20, he was sure, and it came from the direction of the Henry's house. He slipped on his shoes and raced down the stairs, Graff following him. He grabbed the 45 from the hall table and went through the front door. Now was the time he wished he had live flashlight batteries. The moon was up now, so it wasn't too difficult running down the path. From the moon's height, he guessed it was 3 or 4 o'clock. Through the trees, he saw a lantern blinking. He hoped Ben Franklin hadn't shot the shadows. He wasn't prepared for what he saw at the Henrys' barn. He saw them standing there in a ring, Malachi with a lantern in one hand and in the other the ancient single-barreled shotgun that would sometimes shoot, Ben with his gun broken, extracting the empty shells, the Admiral in pajamas, Preacher in a nightshirt, Caleb, his eyes white-rimmed, tentatively poking with his spear at a dark form on the ground. Randy joined the circle and put his hand on Ben Franklin's shoulder. At first he thought it was a wolf. Then he knew it was the biggest German shepherd he had ever seen, his tremendous jaws open in a white snarl of death. It wore a collar. Graff, tail-whipping, sniffed the dead dog, whined, and retreated. Randy leaned over and examined the brass plate on the collar. Malachi held the lantern closer. "Lindy," Randy read aloud. "Mrs. H. G. Cogswell, Rochester, New York. Hillside 51379.
"That dog come an awful long way from home," Preacher said.
"Probably his owners were visiting down here, or on vacation," Randy guessed.
"Well," Malachi said, "I can see why we've been losing hens and how he could take off that pig. He was a mighty big dog. Mighty big. I'll get rid of him in a day, Mr. Randy."
Walking home, Ben Franklin said nothing. Suddenly he stopped, handed Randy the shotgun, covered his face with his hands, and sobbed. Randy squeezed his shoulder. "Take it easy, Ben." Randy thought it was reaction after strain, excitement, and perhaps terror.
"I did exactly what he told me," the boy said. "I heard him coming. I didn't hardly breathe. I didn't pull until I knew I couldn't miss. When he kicked and I thought he was getting up, I let him have the choke barrel. I wouldn't have done it if I'd known he was a dog. Randy, I thought it was a wolf."
Randy stopped in the path and said, "Look at me, Ben." Ben looked up, tear streak shining in the moonlight. "It was a wolf," Randy said. "It wasn't a dog any longer. In times like these, dogs can turn into wolves. You did just right, Ben. Here, take back your gun." The boy took the gun, tucked it under his arm, and they walked on. 10. Randy was having a pleasant, recurrent, before-the-day dream. He was awaking in a hotel in Miami Beach, and a waitress in a white cap was bringing his morning coffee on a rolling table. Sometimes the waitress looked like Lib McGovern, and sometimes like a girl, name forgotten, he had met in Miami. She was always a waitress in the morning, but at night she became an airline stewardess, and they dined together in a little French restaurant where he embarrassed her by eating 6 chocolate eclairs. She said, as always, "Your coffee, Randy, darling." He could hear her saying it, and he could smell the coffee. He drew up his knees and hunched his shoulders and scrunched his head deeper into the pillow so as not to disturb the dream. She shook his shoulder, and he opened his eyes, still smelling coffee, and closed them again. He heard her say, "Damn it, Randy, if you won't wake up and drink your coffee, I'll drink it myself." He opened his eyes wide. It was Lib, without a white cap. Incredibly, she was presenting him a cup of coffee. He reached his face out and tasted it. It burned his tongue delightfully. It was no dream. He swung his feet to the floor and took the saucer and cup. He said, "How?" "How? You did it yourself, you absent-minded monster. Don't you remember putting a jar of coffee in what you called your iron rations?" "No." "Well, you did. A 6-ounce jar of instant, and powdered cream, and believe it or not, a pound of lump sugar. Real sugar, in lumps. I put in 2. Everybody blesses you." Randy lifted his cup, the fog of sleep gone entirely. "How's Dan?" "Terribly sore, and stiff, but stronger. He had 2 cups of coffee and 2 eggs and, of course, orange juice." "Did everybody get coffee?" Yes. We had Florence and Alice over for breakfast. It's 10 o'clock, you know. And I put some in another jar and took it over to the Henrys. The Admiral was out fishing. We'll have to give him his share later. Helen has earmarked the broth and bouillon for Dan until he's better. And the candy for the children. Don't forget Caleb. We won't. Again, he had slept in his clothes and felt grimy. He said, I'm going to shower, and went into the bathroom. Presently, he came out, towel around his middle, and began the hopeless process of honing the hunting knife. Did you know, he said, that Sam Hazard has a straight razor? He's always used one. That's why his face is so pink and unscarred and clean. After I've talked to Dan, I've got to see Sam. Why? He's a military man, and I need help for a military operation. Can I go with you? Darling, you are my right arm. Where I goeth, you can go, up to a point. She watched him while he shaved. All women, he thought, from the youngest on up, seemed fascinated by his travail and agony. Dan was sitting up in bed, his back supported by pillows, his right eye and the right side of his face hidden by bandages. His left eye was purpled, but not quite so swollen as before. Helen sat in a straight-backed chair close to the pillows. She had been reading to him. Of all things, she had been reading the log of Lieutenant Randolph Rousey Peyton, heaved up from the teak sea chest during last night's burrowing for iron rations. Well, you're alive, Randy said. Tell me the tale. Start at the beginning. No, start before the beginning. Where had you been, and where were you going? If the nurse will let me have one more cup of coffee, just one, I'll talk, Dan said. He spoke clearly and without hesitation. There had been no concussion. Each day when he completed his calls, it was Dan Gunn's custom to stop at the bandstand in Marines Park. One of the bandstand pillars had become a special bulletin board on which the people of Fort Repose tacked notices summoning the doctor when there was an emergency. Yesterday there had been such a notice. It read, Dr. Gunn, this morning, Friday, two of my children became violently ill. Kathy has a temperature of 105 and is out of her head. Please come. I am sending this note by Joe Sanchez, who has a horse. Herbert Sunbury. Sunbury, like Dan, was a native New Englander. He had sold a florist shop in Boston 6 years before to migrate to Florida and operate a nursery. He had acquired acreage, built a house, and planted cuttings and seedlings on the Timequin 6 miles upstream of the Bragg House. Dan pushed the Model A fast up River Road. Beyond the Bragg place, the road became a series of curves following the serpentine course of the river. Dan had delivered the last two of the Sunbury's 4 children. He liked the Sunbury's. They were cheerful, industrious, and thoughtful. He knew that unless the emergency was real and pressing, Herb would not have dispatched the note. It was real. It was typhoid. It was the typhoid that Dan had half expected and completely dreaded for weeks, months. Typhoid was the unwelcome, evil sister of any disaster in which the water supply was destroyed or polluted and normal disposal of human waste difficult or impossible. Betty Sunbury said the 2 older children had been headachy and feverish for several days, but not until Friday morning's early hours had they become violently ill, a rosy rash developing on their torsos. Fortunately, Dan could do something. Aspirin and cold compresses to reduce the fever. Terramycin, which came very close to being a specific for typhoid, until the disease was licked, and he had the terramycin. He reached into his bag and brought out the bottle, hoarded for this moment. He could have used the antibiotic a score of times to cure other patients of other diseases, but he had always made do with something else, holding this single bottle as a charm against the evil sister. Now, it would probably save the Sunbury children. In addition, he had enough vaccine to inoculate the elder Sunburys, the 4-year-old, and the babies, and just enough left for Peyton and Ben Franklin when he returned to the house.
correct procedure would be to inoculate the whole town. Dan questioned the Sunberrys closely. They had been very careful. Their drinking water came from a clear, clean spring bubbling from limestone on high ground across the road. Even so, they boiled it. All their foods except citrus they cooked. Dan looked out at the river gliding smoothly by. He was sure the river was the villain. You haven't eaten any raw fish or shrimp or shellfish, have you?
Oh, no, Herb said. Of course not.
What about swimming? Do you swim in the river? Herb looked at Betty.
We don't, Betty said. But Kathy and Herbert Jr., they've been swimming in the river since March.
That's it, I guess, Dan said. If the germs are in the river, it only takes one gulp. Somewhere in the headwaters of the Timucuan, or in the great mysterious swamps from which slender streams sluggishly moved toward the St. John's, a typhoid carrier had lived, undetected. A hermit, perhaps, or a respectable churchwoman in a small truck farm community. When this person's sanitary facilities failed, germ-laden feces had reached the rivers. Thus Dan reconstructed it, driving back toward town on the winding road. Dan was so absorbed in his deductions and forebodings that he failed to see the woman sitting on the edge of the road until he was almost abreast of her. He stepped on the brakes hard and the car jarred to a stop. The woman wore jeans and a man's shirt. Her right knee was drawn almost up to her chin and she held her ankle in both hands, her body rocking as if in pain. A swatch of metallic blonde hair curtained her features. Dan's first thought was that she had turned her ankle, his second, that she could be a decoy for an ambush. Yet highwaymen rarely operated on unfrequented and therefore unprofitable roads and had never been reported this close to Fort Repose. The woman looked up, appealingly. He could easily have switched gears and gone on, but he was a physician, and he was Dan Gunn. He turned off the engine and got out of the car. As soon as his feet touched the macadam, he sensed from her expression that he had stepped into a trap. Whatever her face showed, it was not pain. When her eyes shifted and she smiled, he knew her performance had been completed. Behind him, a man spoke.
All right, Mac, you don't have to go any further.
Dan swung around. The man who had spoken was one of three, all oddly dressed and all armed. They had materialized from behind scrub palmettos at the side of the road. The leader was squat and wore a checked gold cap and Bermuda shorts. His arms were abnormally long and hands huge. He carried a submachine gun and handled it like a toy. His belly bulged over his waistband. He ate well. Dan said, "Look, I'm a doctor. I'm the doctor of Fort Repose. I don't have anything you want." The second man advanced on Dan. He was hatless, dressed in a striped sports shirt, and he gripped a baseball bat with both hands.
"Get that, Mac," he said. "He don't have nothing we want. Ain't that rich?"
The third man was not a man at all, but a boy with fuzz on his chin. The boy wore Levi's, a wide-brimmed hat, high-heeled boots, and twin holster belts slung low. He stood apart from the others, legs spread, hefting a long-barreled revolver in each hand. He looked like an immature imitation of a Western bad man holding up the Wells Fargo stage, but he seemed overly excited, and Dan guessed him the most volatile and dangerous of the three. The woman, grinning, got in the car, wrestled the back seat to the floor, and found the two bottles of bourbon Dan kept hidden there.
"Just like you heard, Buster," she said. "The doc keeps a traveling bar."
"That's my anesthetic," Dan said. Without looking at the woman, the leader said,
"Just leave the liquor in the car, rum-dum. We'll take everything as is. Start walking, Doc."
Dan said, "At least let me have my bag. All the instruments and medicines I've got are in there." The boy giggled.
"How about letting me put him out of his misery, Mick? He's too ignorant to live."
The man with the machine gun took two steps to the side. Dan knew why. The car's gas tank was in his line of fire. The machine gun moved. Get going, Doc. Dan thought of everything that was in his bag, including the typhoid shots for Peyton and Ben Franklin. He took a step toward the car. He saw the baseball bat swinging and tried to close with the man, knowing he was foolish, knowing that he was awkward and clumsy. The bat grazed his face and he tripped and fell. As he tried to rise, he saw the boy's high-heeled boot coming at his eyes and the man with the bat danced to the side, ready to swing again. His head seemed to explode. In a final split second of consciousness, he thought, I am dead. He awoke dazed, almost totally blind, and unable to determine whether he had been shot as well as slugged and beaten. He waited to die and wanted to die. When he didn't die, he sat for a long time trying to decide which way was home. It required great effort to concentrate on the simplest matter. He would have preferred to stay where he was and complete his dying, but the sight of ants wheeling excitedly around the drying blood on the road made him uneasy. If he died there, the ants would be all over him and in him by the time he was found. It would be better to die at home, cleanly. The sun was setting. The Sunbury house was east of Fort Repose. Therefore, he must go west. With the orange sun as his beacon, he began to crawl. When darkness came, he rested, bathed his face in ditch water, and drank it too, and tried walking. He could walk perhaps 100 yards before the road spun up to meet him. And then he would crawl. Thus, walking and crawling, he had finally reached the Bragg steps. When Dan finished, Randy said, It had to come, of course. The highwaymen killed off travel on the main highways, and so now they've started on the little towns and the secondary roads. But in this case, Dan, it sounds like they were laying for you personally. I think they knew you were a doctor and you'd be going way out River Road to the Sunburys, and certainly the woman knew you kept a couple of bottles of bourbon in the car. All they had to do, Dan said, was hang around Marines Park, look at the notices on the bandstand and ask questions. I didn't know any of them, but I think I've seen one before, the youngest. I used to see him hanging around Hochstatler's drugstore before the day. They didn't have a car? No. I guess what they wanted most was transportation. They won't get much. We had only 2 or 3 gallons of gas left, he added apologetically. I'm sorry, Randy. I was careless. I shouldn't have stopped. I've lost our transport, our medicines, and my tools. Leaning over the bed, Randy's fingers interlocked. He unconsciously squeezed until the tendons on his forearm stood out like taut wires. He said, Don't worry about it. Worst of all, Dan said, I've lost my glasses. I guess they smashed when that goon slugged me with the bat. I won't be much good without glasses. Randy knew that Dan's vision was poor. Dan was forced to wear bifocals. He was very nearsighted. Don't you have another pair? He asked. Yes, in the bag. I always kept my spare glasses in the bag because I was afraid I might lose or break the pair I was wearing on a call. He sat up straight in bed, his face twisted. Randy, I may never be able to get another pair of glasses. Randy stood up. I've got to start working on this, Dan. What are you going to do? Find them and kill them. He said this in a matter-of-fact manner, as if announcing that he was going downtown to have his tires checked in the time before the day. Dan said, I'm afraid you're going at this wrong, Randy. Killing highwaymen is secondary. The important thing is the typhoid in the river. If you think things are bad now, wait until we have typhoid in Fort Repose. And it's not only Fort Repose. It goes from the Timaquinnan to the St. John's and downriver to Sanford, Palatka, and the other towns, if they are still there. All I can do about typhoid is warn people, which you have done already and which I will do again. I can't shoot a germ. I'm concerned with the highwaymen right now, this minute. Next they'll start raiding the houses.
It's as inevitable as the fact that they left the main highways and ambushed you on River Road. Typhoid is bad. So is murder and robbery and rape. I am an officer in the reserve. I have been legally designated to keep order when normal authority breaks down, which it certainly has here. And the first thing I must do to keep order is execute the highwayman. That's perfectly plain. See you later, Dan. Randy turned to Helen. Take care of him. Feed him up, he said, a command. Walking beside him toward the Admiral's house, Lib found it difficult to keep pace. She had never seen Randy look and speak and act like this before. She held his arm, and yet she felt he had moved away from her. He did not seem anxious to talk, confide in her, or ask her opinion as he usually did. He had moved into man's august world of battle and violence from which she was barred. She held tighter to his arm. She was afraid. The Admiral, freshly shaven and pink-faced, was in his den touching whale oil to the recoil mechanism of an automatic shotgun.
I was wondering, he said to Randy, whether you would be around here or I should come to you. How's Dan?
He'll be all right. We lost the car and the medicines and the last of the bourbon, but we didn't lose our doctor. The most important thing we lost were his glasses. He's very nearsighted.
You forgot something, the Admiral said, hardly looking up from his work. We not only have lost transport, but communications. We no longer have a way to recharge batteries. This battery I have now, he nodded at the radio, is good for perhaps another 8 to 10 hours. After that, he looked up, nothing. Silence. What do you plan to do?
I plan to kill them, but I don't know how to find them. I came to talk to you about it. Lib said, may I interrupt? Don't look at me that way, Randy. I'm not trying to interfere in your business. I just wanted to say I brought the Admiral's coffee. While you're talking, I thought I'd boil water and make a cup for him. The Admiral said absently, kettle's in the fireplace. She went into the living room. It was silly, but sometimes the Admiral irritated her. The Admiral made her feel like a mess boy.
Sam Hazard laid the automatic 16 gently on the desk. Ever since I heard about it, I've been thinking, he said. You have to go get them. They won't come to you. Not only that, they may be 100 miles from here by now.
I think they're right around here, Randy said. One of the gang was a local drugstore cowboy, now toting 2 real guns. And they don't have enough gas to get far. I think they'll try to score a few more times before they move on. Even when they're gone, others will come. We have the problem whether it's this particular gang or another gang. I'm going to try to form a provisional company.
Vigilantes?
No, a company under martial law. So far as I know, I'm the only active Army Reserve officer in town, so I guess it's up to me.
Then what do you do?
Lib came in and set a cup beside each of them. She found a clear space at the far end of the room-length desk, boosted herself up, and attempted to appear inconspicuous. Suppose I organized a patrol on foot to set up roadblocks, Randy suggested.
The highwaymen were mobile. You're not, the Admiral said. If they see an armed patrol or a roadblock, they'll simply keep out of your way.
Randy said, well, we can't just sit here and wait for them.
All this I've been thinking, the Admiral said. Also, I was thinking of the Q-ships we used in the First World War.
Lib started to speak, but decided it would be unwise. It was Randy who said, I remember vaguely reading about Q-ships, but I don't remember much about it. Enlighten me, Sam.
Q-ships were usually auxiliary schooners or worn-out tramps, targets on which a German submarine captain wouldn't be likely to waste a torpedo, but would prefer to sink with gunfire. Concealed a pretty hefty battery behind screens that looked like deck loads. Drill was to prowl submarine alley unescorted and helpless-looking. The sub seizer and surfaces. Sometimes the Q-ship had a panic party that took to the boats. Best part of the act. Soon as the sub opened fire with its deck gun, the Q-ship ran up the flag and unmasked the battery. Blammy. It was quite effective.
Very ingenious. But what has it got to do with highwaymen?
Nothing at all,
unless you can put a four-wheeled Q-ship on the roads around Fort Repose.
Randy shrugged. We're not mobile. Plenty of cars we could use, for instance yours, Sam, but gasoline is practically non-existent. We might have to cruise around for days before they tackled us. I might be able to requisition a gallon or two here and there, but then the word would get around and they'd be watching for us.
Lib had to speak. Could I make a suggestion? I think Rita Hernandez and her brother must have gasoline. They're the big traders in town, aren't they?
Randy had tried to wipe Rita out of his mind. They were even. They were quits. He wanted nothing from Rita anymore. He said,
"It's true that if anybody's holding gas, it's Rita."
"Not only that," Lib said, "but they have that grocery truck. Can you imagine anything more enticing to highwaymen than a grocery truck? They won't really think it's filled with groceries, of course, but psychologically it would be irresistible."
Sam Hazard smiled with his eyes, as if light from within penetrated the opaque gray.
"There you have it, Randy. Nice staff work, my girl."
"Also," she said, "I think it would be a good idea if I drove. They'd be sure to think it was easy pickings with a woman driving."
"You will, like the devil, drive," Randy said. "You will stay at home and guard the house, you and Ben Franklin."
And the two men went on talking and planning as if they already possessed the truck with full tank and she was left out of it again. At least, she thought, if it really worked, she had contributed something. The Admiral emphasized that whatever was done must be done quietly. Randy decided he could not go to the Hernandez house until after dark. It was not impossible that the highwaymen were holed up in Pistolville or had contacts there. If Pistolville saw him drive off in Rita's truck, the news would be all over town within a few hours. Finally, the Admiral asked the crucial question, would Rita cooperate? Was she discreet?
"Rita wants to hold what she has," Randy said. "Rita wants to live. She is realistic."
There was one more thing he must do before he left the Admiral. He sat at the typewriter and pecked out the orders. Order number 1, Town of Fort Repose. 1. In accordance with the proclamation of Mrs. Josephine Van Brucker Brown, Acting President of the United States, and the Declaration of Martial Law, I am assuming command of the town of Fort Repose and its environs. 2. All Army, Navy, and Air Force reservists, and all members of the National Guard, together with any others with military experience who will volunteer, will meet at the bandstand at 1200 hours, Wednesday, 20 April. I propose to form a composite company to protect this town. Order number 2. 1. 2 cases of typhoid have been diagnosed in the Sunbury family, Upper River Road. It must be assumed that both the Timequin and St. John's are polluted. 2. All water will be boiled before drinking. Do not eat fruits or greens that have been washed in unboiled water. Order number 3. 1. Dr. Daniel Gunn, our only physician, has been beaten and robbed by highwaymen. 2. The penalty for robbery or pillage or for harboring highwaymen or for failure to make known information concerning their whereabouts or movements is death by hanging. All these orders he signed, Randolph Rousey Bragg, 1st Lieutenant, AUS Reserve, 0265-8988. Lib, reading over his shoulder, said, "Why wait until Wednesday to form your company?"
"I want the highwaymen to think that they have plenty of time," Randy said. "I want them to laugh at us."
There were a number of ways by which Randy could have traveled the 3 miles to Marines Park and then the 2 additional miles to the Hernandez house on the outer fringe of Pistolville. The Admiral had offered to take him as far as the town dock on his outboard cruiser, now converted to sail. But Sam Hazard had not as yet added additional keel to the boat, so it would sideslip badly on attack. Sam could get him to Marines Park all right, but on the return trip might be unable to make headway against current and wind and be left stranded. Randy could have borrowed Alice Cooksey's bicycle, but decided that this might make him conspicuous in Pistolville.
He could have ridden Balaam, the mule, but if he succeeded in persuading Rita to let him have the truck and gasoline, how would Balaam get home? Balaam didn't fit in a panel truck. Besides, he was not sure that Balaam should ever be risked away from the Henry's fields and barn. The only mule in Timucan County was beyond price. In the end, he decided to walk. He set out after dark. Lib escorted him as far as the bend in the road. She had tacked his notices firmly to a square of plywood, which he was to nail to the bandstand pillar. Thus, she had explained, they would not be lost or overlooked among the offers to trade fishhooks or lighter flints and the pleas for kerosene or kettles. Across the top of the board she had printed official bulletins. Randy wore stained dungarees, old brown fishing sneakers, and a floppy black hat borrowed from Two-Tone. His pistol was concealed in a deep pocket. When walking Pistolville at night, he wanted to look as if he belonged there. When he told Lib it was time to turn back, she kissed him. "How long will it take you, darling?" she asked. "Depends on whether I get the truck. Counting the stop at the park to nail up the orders. I should get there in less than 2 hours. After that, I don't know. Depends on Rita." "If you're not home by midnight," she said, "I'll come after you with a shotgun." She sounded half serious. In the past few weeks, she had been more tender to him, embarrassingly solicitous of his safety, more jealous of his time. She was possessive, which was natural. They were lovers when there was time and place and privacy and respite from fatigue and hunger and the dangers and responsibilities of the day. He walked on alone under the oak arch, excluding starlight, secure in night's black velvet cloak, yet walking silently, eyes, ears, and even nose alert. So he had learned in the dark hammocks as a boy hunting game, in the dark mountains as a man hunting man. Before the day, except in hunting or in war, a 5 or 10 mile walk would have been unthinkable. Now it was routine for all of them except Dan, and after Dan got out of bed, it would become routine for him too. But all their shoes were wearing out. In another month or two, Ben Franklin and Peyton would be without shoes entirely. Not only were the children walking or running everywhere, but their feet inconsiderately continued to grow, straining canvas and leather. Randy told himself that he must discover whether Eli Blaustein still held shoes. He knew what Blaustein wanted, meat. Marines Park was empty. As he nailed up his order board, an animal scuttled out from under the bandstand. At first he thought it a possum, but when he caught its silhouette against the starlit river, he saw it was an armadillo. Walking through the business section, he wondered whether armadillos were good eating. Before the day, he had heard someone say that there were several hundred thousand armadillos in Florida. This was strange, because before the first boom, there had been no armadillos at all. Randy's father had related the story. Some real estate promoter on the East Coast had imported 2 from Texas for a roadside zoo. Knowing nothing of the habits of armadillos, the real estate man had pinned them behind chicken wire. When darkness fell, the armadillos instantly burrowed out, and within a few years, armadillos were undermining golf greens and dumping over citrus trees from St. Augustine to Palm Beach. They had spread everywhere, having no natural enemies in the state except automobiles. Since the automobile had been all but exterminated by the hydrogen bomb, the armadillo population was certain to multiply. Soon there would be more armadillos than people in Florida. It was Saturday night, but in the business blocks of Yulee and St. John's, no light showed, nor did he see a human being. In the residential area, perhaps half the houses showed a light, but rarely from more than one room. He had not seen a moving vehicle since leaving home, and not until he reached the pine shanties and patchwork bungalows of Pistolville did he see a person. These people were shadows, swiftly fading behind a half-open door or bobbing from house to house. It was night, and Fort Repose was in fear. He was relieved when he saw lights in the Hernandez house. Anything could have happened since he and Dan had stopped there. Pete could have died, and Rita could have decamped, or she could have been killed, the house pillaged, and everything she was holding, including the truck and gasoline, stolen.
He knocked on the door.
"Who is it?"
Rita's voice said. He knew she would have the shotgun up and ready.
"Randy."
She opened the door. She was holding a shotgun, as he guessed. She stared at his costume.
"Come in. Looking for a handout?"
"In a sense, yes."
"What happened? Your two women run you off?"
As she laid down the gun, the burn still showed on her ring finger. He said, "How's Pete?"
"Weaker. How's Dr. Gunn?"
"You heard about it, then?"
"Sure. I hear all the bad news in a hurry nowadays. We call it lip radio."
The word had come to town, Randy guessed, via Alice Cooksey earlier in the day. Just as Alice brought the town news to River Road, so each day she carried the news from River Road to town. Once spoken in the library, the news would spread through Fort Repose, street to street and house to house. He said, "You know, Dr. Gunn lost his bag with all his instruments and what drugs he had left in his glasses. So if we can, we have to get those highwaymen, and that's why I came to you, Rita."
"They're not Pistolville people," she said. "These Pistolville crackers hardly have got gumption enough to rob each other. Now, I heard them described, and one of them, the young one with two guns, was probably Leroy Settle, a punk who lived on the other side of town. His mother still lives there, I think. Maybe if you stake out his house, you'll get a shot at him."
"I don't want him in particular," Randy said. "I want them all. I want them and everybody like them." And he told her what his plan was exactly, and why he must have the grocery truck and the gasoline if she had any. He knew he must trust her entirely or not at all. She listened him out and said nothing. "If you are left alone here, Rita," he said, "with all the canned food and other stuff you've got, you're bound to become a target. When they've cleaned out what's on the roads, they'll start on the houses."
"I'm way ahead of you." Her eyes met his steadily. She was evaluating him and all the chances, all the odds. She made her decision. "I think you can get away with it, Randy."
"You're holding gas, then?"
"Certainly I'm holding gas. 15 gallons under the back steps. You can have it and the truck. Anything you don't use, I expect back."
He rose. "What are you going to tell people when they see your truck is gone?"
"I'm going to tell them it was stolen. I'm going to tell them it was loaded with choice trade goods, and that while I was in the bedroom attending to Pete, somebody jimmied the ignition and stole it. And to make it sound good, I'm going to let off a blast with this gun when you whip out of the driveway. The news will get around fast, don't worry. It'll get to the highwaymen, and they'll be looking for the truck. That should help, shouldn't it?"
"It should make it perfect."
"Go out the back way. Load the cans in the back of the truck quietly. There's enough gas in the tank to take you out River Road. I'll salute you when you hit the street."
He said, "You're a smart girl, Rita."
"Am I?"
She held out her left hand to show the black circle left by the radioactive diamond ring.
"I've got a wedding band. I was married to an H-bomb. Will it ever go away, Randy?"
"Sure," he said, hoping it would. "Dan will look at it again when he's better." He walked through the hallway and kitchen and out into the darkness. He found the 3 5-gallon cans under the back steps, opened the truck's rear doors, and silently loaded the gasoline. He got in and stepped on the starter. The engine turned over, protesting. Rita had been careless, he guessed, and had forgotten to fill the battery with distilled water, for it was close to dead. He tried again, and the engine caught. He nursed the choke until it ran smoothly, backed out of the Hernandez carport, turned sharply in the yard, shifted gears, and roared out on the street. He glimpsed Rita's silhouette in the doorway, the gun rising to her shoulder, and for an awful instant thought she was aiming at him. Red flame leaped out of the muzzle. At the first corner, he cut away from Augustine Road and followed rutted dirt streets until he was clear of Pistolville. He saw no other cars in motion on the way home. It was past 11 when he drove the truck into the garage and closed the doors so no casual passerby or visitor would see it. The lights were out in Florence's house, and in his own house only a single light burned in his office window. That would be Lib, waiting up for him.
He had urged the women to get to bed at their usual hour or earlier, for they planned to go to the Easter sunrise services in Marines Park. This was good. It was good that they should all be there, so that no one would guess of unusual activity out on River Road. From a less practical standpoint, he felt good about it, too. He was, as a matter of fact, surprised at their anticipation and enthusiasm. Many things had happened in the past few days, and yet their conversation always came back to the Easter services. People hadn't been like that before the day. He could not imagine any of them voluntarily getting up before dawn and then walking 3 miles on empty stomachs to watch the sun come up, sing hymns, and listen to sermons, however short. He wished he could walk with them. He couldn't. It was necessary that he remain there to complete his plans with Sam Hazard and also to work on the truck. Walking toward the house, he wondered at this change in people and concluded that man was a naturally gregarious creature, and they were all starved for companionship and the sight of new faces. Marines Park would be their church, their theater, their assembly hall. Man absorbed strength from the touch of his neighbor's elbow. It was these reasons, perhaps, that accounted for the success of the old-time Chautauquas. It could be that and something more, the discovery that faith had not died under the bombs and missiles. She wasn't upstairs. She was waiting in the gloom of the porch. She said, "I saw you drive it in. It's beautiful. Did you get the gas to go with it?" "Total of 17 gallons, including what's in the tank. We can cruise for a day or two if we take it easy." "Are you tired, darling?" "Not too. If you're going to be up at 5 with the others, you really ought to be in bed." "I've been waiting for you, Randy. I worry. I'm not tired, really." They walked through the grove down to the dock. The river whispered. The quarter moon showed its profile. The stars moved. She lay on her back, head resting on her locked fingers, looking up at the stars. His eyes measured her, long, slender, curved as if for flight, skin coppery, hair silvered by the night. "You're a beautiful possession," he said. "I wish we had a place of our own so I could keep you. I wish we had just one room to ourselves. I wish we were married." Instantly, she said, "I accept. I'm not sure how we'd go about it. Last I heard, the courthouse in San Marco wasn't operating. For a while, it was an emergency shelter like our school. I don't know what they use it for now, but certainly not for issuing marriage licenses. And the county clerk has disappeared. I heard in the park that he took his family and started for an uncontaminated zone in Georgia where he used to live." Without moving her head, she said, "Randy, under martial law, can't you make your own rules?" "I hadn't thought about it." "I suppose so." "Well, make one." "You're serious, aren't you?" "I certainly am. It may be an old-fashioned, before-the-day attitude, but if I'm going to have children, I'd like to be married." "Children? Are you going to have a baby?" Thought of the difficulties, dangers, and complexities of having a baby under their present circumstances appalled him. "I don't know. I can't say that I am. But then again, I can't say that I'm not, can I? I would like to marry you tomorrow before you go off chasing highwaymen." She turned on her side to face him. "It isn't really convention. It is only that I love you very much, and that if anything happened, I don't have any bad premonitions, dear, but you and I know that a bad thing could happen. Well, if anything happened, I would want the child to have your name. You'd want that too, wouldn't you?" "Yes," Randy said. "I would want that very much. I'm not going to put the truck on the road until late in the afternoon. That's when the highwaymen took Dan. So there'll be time." "That's nice," she said. "It'll be nice to marry on Easter Sunday." He took her hands and drew her up and held her. Over her shoulder, he saw a pair of green eyes and a dark snout sliding downstream past the edge of the dock. It was spring and the gators were out of their holes. He had heard somewhere that the Seminoles ate gator meat, cut their tails into steaks. It was a source of meat that should be investigated.
He knew he shouldn't be thinking about food at this time, but he was hungry again.
11. Elizabeth McGovern and Randolph Bragg were married at noon that Easter Sunday. The bride wore the same white silk dress she had worn to the sunrise service in Marines Park. She was unsteady on high heels, for she had not worn heels since the day. The groom wore his Class A uniform with the bold patch of the 1st Cavalry Division on his arm and the ribbons of the Korean War and Bronze Star on his chest, along with the blue badge of the combat infantryman. He wore the uniform not because of the wedding, but because it was required in the radioed orders to reservists assuming active duty, such as ambushing and killing highwaymen, which he presently intended to do. The bride was given away by her father, W. Foxworth McGovern, the retired Cleveland manufacturer. Bill McGovern, who had been helping Malachi cut gun ports in the thin steel sides and rear doors of the grocery truck, wore greasy dungarees. A chisel had slipped and one of his hands was bleeding. The best man was Dr. Daniel Gunn. He was clad in a tent-sized striped bathrobe. Grinning through his red beard, his head bandaged, a square gauze patch covering his right eye, he looked like a turbaned Mediterranean pirate. Among the guests was Rear Admiral Samuel P. Hazard, USN retired, who wore khaki shorts, a khaki hunting vest bulging with buckshot shells, and during the ceremony held his gold braided cap across his stomach. The matron of honor was Mrs. Helen Bragg, the presumed widow of Colonel Mark Bragg. She furnished the wedding ring, stripping it from her own finger. The ceremony was held in the high-ceilinged parlor of the Bragg House. The marriage was performed by the Reverend Clarence Henry, pastor emeritus of the Afro-Repose Baptist Church. Randy was certain it was perfectly legal. It was performed under his order number 4, written that morning in Sam Hazard's house. Malachi and Bill McGovern had been working on the truck, and Randy was breakfasting with Dan Gunn when the women and children returned from Marines Park. The services had been wonderful, they said, but the news they brought was terrible. During the night, highwaymen had raided the isolated home of Jim Hickey, the beekeeper, on the Pasco Creek Road. They had killed Jim and his wife. The two children had walked to Fort Repose and found their aunt's home. Whether it was the same band that had beaten Dan Gunn was uncertain. The Hickey children were inarticulate and hysterical with fear and shock. Randy, raging for immediate retaliation, had raced to the Admiral's house with the news. The Admiral's experience in meeting the unpredictable and brutish pranks of war had saved them from premature or imprudent action.
"Wasn't this sort of thing exactly what we expected?" Sam Hazard asked.
"I suppose so, but damn it,
I don't think we should change our plans by so much as a minute. If we put out with the truck now, we'll just burn fuel for nothing. These people operate like beasts, Randy. Having gorged themselves in the night, they sleep through the mornings, perhaps through the whole day."
Randy, recognizing the sense of this, had calmed himself. They had talked of the wedding and the legal problems attending martial law, and the Admiral had helped him in framing Order Number 4. It read, "Until county offices resume operations and normal communications are reestablished between this town and the Timequin County seat, the following regulations will govern marriages and births in Fort Repose. 1. Marriages can be performed by any ordained minister. Marriage licenses and health certificates are waived. 2. Marriage certificates will be issued by the presiding minister and will be valid when signed by the contracting parties, the minister, and 2 witnesses. 3. So that a permanent record may be preserved, a copy of the certificate will be left at the Fort Repose Library. I designate Librarian Alice Cooksey custodian of these records. I designate Miss Florence Wetcheck her deputy. 4. Birth records, signed by the attending physician or midwife, or by the mother and any witnesses if medical attention is unavailable, will be deposited in the same manner.
One copy of this order is to be kept with the records in the library. This order is retroactive to the day, so that any births or marriages that have occurred since the day may be properly recorded." Randy signed order number 4 and said, "Well, when the rules are off, you make your own."
"This is a good one," Sam Hazard said. "I wonder what they're doing elsewhere."
"Elsewhere?"
"There must be hundreds of towns in the same fix we're in. Local authority collapsed or inoperative, communications out. I fancy that elsewhere they're not doing so good."
"How could they be worse?"
Randy was thinking of what had happened to Dan Gunn and the Hickeys.
"They could be," the Admiral said positively.
Randy had gone to see Preacher next. "Preacher," he said, "you're an ordained minister, aren't you?"
"I sure am," Preacher said. "I am not only ordained, but in my church I can ordain people."
"Would you mind marrying Miss McGovern and me?"
"We don't have a regular courthouse license, naturally, but I have fixed it up to make it legal under martial law." "Miss McGovern told me you was going to wed, Mr. Randy. I will be happy to marry you. I don't need papers. I've joined maybe 1,000 pairs in my life. Some had papers, some didn't. Some stuck, some didn't. The papers didn't make the difference. It's the people, not the papers."
So they were married, in a room filled with flowers of the season and furniture of less bitter centuries and people of all ages. Randy produced the certificate, and when Preacher signed it, he signed Reverend Clarence Henry. And Randy realized that this was the first time he had ever known Preacher's full name, although Preacher had always been there. Randy had found a large-scale county map in his desk, and they had planned their movement as carefully as a Q-ship captain plotting his course through Submarine Alley. There were 4 roads that led out from Fort Repose. River Road stretched east along the Timaquin until it swung into a main highway to the beaches. The Pasco Creek Road ran north, the San Marco Road west from the bridge across the St. John's. A narrow substandard road followed the St. John's toward its headwaters. The map, with 2 crosses to mark where the highwaymen had stopped Dan Gunn and killed the Hickeys, lay on the garage floor. They bent over it, Randy tracing the route they would take. The highwaymen could be anywhere. They could be one band or 2 or more. They could be gone entirely. It was all guesswork, and yet it was necessary to plan the route so as to cover the most territory using the least amount of gas, for when the truck's tank was empty, that would be all. There was no reserve, not anywhere. They would take River Road first because it was closest. After 12 miles, a little used lateral led toward Pasco Creek, and they would go almost to Pasco Creek and then cut into the road for Fort Repose. Thus, by using the clay or washboard laterals, they could avoid retracing the same highway and save a few miles. On his hands and knees, his seagoing cap pushed back on his pink head, the Admiral murmured, "Give me a fast ship, for I intend to go in harm's way." "Paul Jones. Remember, Randy, this should be a very slow ship. The slower we go, the less gas we use and the more chance they have of spotting us." Randy was going to drive. Malachi, Sam Hazard, and Bill McGovern were to be concealed in the body of the truck. Randy said, "I don't like to drive slow, but I can. I think about 20 miles an hour is right. Anything slower would look suspicious." He checked the weapons. They were taking everything that might be handy. The automatic 16 for the Admiral and the double 20 for Bill McGovern. Malachi would have the carbine. The big Krag, long as a Kentucky squirrel rifle and as unwieldy, would be in reserve. From Dan's description of how the highwaymen had acted, Randy guessed that the firefight, when it came, would be close in and the shotguns of greater value than the rifles. He himself, alone behind the wheel, would have only the .45 automatic on the seat beside him. That and the hunting knife, which was almost, but not quite, razor sharp in a sheath at his belt. Randy walked around the truck for a final look.
He thought he was doing something that was familiar, and then he remembered that he had seen aircraft commanders do this before takeoff. He examined the tires. They were good. The battery water had been replenished in the battery run-up. Malachi and Bill had done a good job on the gun ports, ferrying them into the big painted letters Ajax Supermarket. On each side, one port in the J and one in the M. Camouflage. The holes cut into the rear doors under the tiny glass windows were more conspicuous. Randy went outside and returned with a handful of mud. He spread it on the edges of the ports, erasing the glint of freshly cut metal. It was 4 o'clock, the time to sortie. "You know your positions," he said. "Sam, you have the starboard side. Bill takes the port. Malachi, the stern. If I see your fire can't be effective from inside, I'll yell out, and everybody gets out fast while I cover you." Then, at the last second, there was a change. Malachi suggested it. "Mr. Randy, I want to say something. I don't think you ought to drive. I think I ought to drive." Randy was furious, but he held his voice down. "Let's not get everything screwed up now. Get in, Malachi." Malachi made no move. "Sir, that uniform, it don't go with the truck." "They won't see it until they stop us," Randy said. "Then it'll be too late. Anyway, all sorts of people are wearing all sorts of clothes. I'll bet you'd see highwaymen in uniforms if they got their hands on them." "That ain't all, sir," Malachi said. "It's your face. It's white. They're more likely to tackle a black face than a white face. They see my face. They say, 'Huh, here's something soft and probably with no gun.' So they relax. Maybe it gives us that extra second, Mr. Randy." Randy hesitated. He had confidence in Malachi's driving and in his judgment and courage. But it was the driver who would have to do the talking, if there was any talking, and who would have to keep his hands off the pistol. That would be the hardest thing. The admiral spoke very carefully.
"Now, Randy, I'm not trying to outrank you. You're the captain, you're in command, and it's your decision. But I think Malachi is right. Dungarees in a black face are better than a uniform in a white face."
Randy said, "Okay. You're right. You drive, Malachi. You take the pistol up front. Keep it out of sight. There's only one thing to remember. When they stop us, they'll all be watching you. They don't know we're here. They'll be watching you, and they'll kill you if you go for your gun. So leave your gun alone until we start shooting." Malachi grinned and said, "Yes, sir." And they got in and departed. Looking through the glass in the rear door, Randy saw his wife and Helen and Dan on the porch. They were waving. Peyton was there too, but she was not waving. She had her face buried in her mother's dress. They drove east on River Road. After a few miles, Randy told Malachi to look for signs of the place where Dan Gunn had been decoyed and beaten. They found a sign. Since there was no longer any care of the roads, the grass had grown high on the shoulders, and in one place it was trampled. In a ditch nearby, they discovered slivers of broken glass. Then they found the twisted and empty frame of Dan's glasses. The frame was useless, and yet Randy picked it up and shoved it in a pocket. A lawyer's gesture, he thought. Evidence. They drove on, past the Sunbury home. Randy was tempted to order a stop to inquire about the children's typhoid. Dan would want to know. He did not stop. The Sunburys were good people, and he trusted them, but the truck was a secret, a military secret, and it was senseless to expose it. River Road was clear. Nothing moved on River Road. They took the lateral north. Even though Malachi avoided the worst potholes and drove with exasperating deliberation, it was rough riding. It shook up Bill McGovern and Sam Hazard. They were older, and they would tire. Near Pasco Creek, they passed a group of inhabited shacks. Approaching them, Malachi called back, "People!" Randy turned and looked over Malachi's shoulder. He could see from behind the front seat, but not be seen. He saw two children scurry indoors, and at another place a bearded man crouched behind a woodpile, training a gun on the truck. He made no hostile move, but the muzzle tracked them. It was obvious that few people traveled this road, and those who did were not welcome. Randy was relieved when they turned into the better road toward Fort Repose. They were all stiff by then, for it was impossible to stand upright in the panel truck. The Admiral and Bill could sit cross-legged on the floor and view the landscape through their ports, but Randy had to half-crouch to see through the rear windows. When the truck reached higher ground, where the road was straight and they could see anything approach for nearly a mile, he told Malachi to stop. "We'll take 10," he said. He threw open the back doors and got out groaning, feeling permanently warped. He walked, waving his arms and flexing his knees. Bill McGovern shuffled down the road, humpbacked. The Admiral tried to stretch, and a joint or tendon cracked audibly. He cursed. Malachi grinned. "Now I see why you wanted to drive," Randy said. He looked both ways. Nothing was coming. He went back to the truck and found the thermos Lib had given him. He opened it, expecting water. It was sweetened black coffee. "Look," he said. "Look what Lib, my wife, did for us." He knew it was the last of the jar. There was a cup for each, but they decided to take only half a cup then, saving the rest for the tag end of evening when they might need it more. They got back into the truck and continued the patrol. Past the Hickey house, empty, door open, windows wantonly smashed. Randy noticed that the beekeeper's car was gone. Jim Hickey, with such valuable trading goods as honey and beeswax, must have been holding gasoline. In the past month, anyone who had it would have traded gas for honey. The objective of the highwaymen was probably the car and the gas, Randy deduced, rather than honey. This conclusion disheartened him. The highwaymen might be hundreds of miles from Fort Repose now. Nearing Fort Repose, they must avoid being seen in the town. They turned off on a winding, high-crowned clay road that ran 2 miles to an antique-covered bridge across the St. John's. Once across the river, they would turn south and shortly thereafter hit the road to San Marco. Rattling over the clay washboard, it seemed hardly worthwhile to keep a watch from the back, and yet Randy did. Suddenly, he saw that they were being followed. He had seen no car on the Pasco Creek Road before making the turn. They had passed no car on the clay lateral, nor any houses either. The car was simply there, following them at a respectable distance, making no effort to catch them, and yet not dropping back. He recalled an abandoned citrus packing shed at the turn. It must have been concealed there. Randy called so that Malachi could clearly hear. "We've got company about 300 yards back." He strained his eyes through the dirty little rear windows. It was difficult to make them focus, like trying to train a gun from a bouncing jeep, and it was almost dusk. It was a late-model light gray hardtop or sedan, and Jim Hickey had owned such a car. But all makes looked pretty much alike, and it seemed half of them were either light gray or off-white. He called to Malachi, "Speed up a little, see what happens." Malachi increased their speed to 40 or 45. The car behind maintained its distance exactly, as if it were tied to them. This proved nothing. This would be standard operating procedure for an honest citizen following a strange truck on a lonely, unfrequented road. He wouldn't want to get too close, but he was probably in a hurry to get home before dark. So if the truck sped up, he would too. "Drop back to 20, Randy ordered. The truck slowed. So did the car. Again, this proved nothing except caution. Randy turned to Sam Hazard and Bill McGovern. "This fellow behind us is either an innocent bystander or he's hurting us." "Hurting us?" Bill said. "Hurting us into the gun of some pal up front." They hit a smoother strip of road and Randy could see 2 men in the car. He thought the back was empty, but he couldn't be sure. 2 of them, both men. They rode on silently. This was entirely different from a patrol in war when you went out in fear and despite your fear, hoping you would find no trouble. His only fear was that they might miss them, exhaust their gas in futile cruising, and lose their one best chance to wipe them out. This was a personal matter and a matter of survival. It was like having a nest of coral snakes under the house. You had to go in after them and kill them, or certainly one day they would kill a child or your dog. In a matter such as this, the importance of your own life diminished, so he prayed that the men behind were highwaymen. In a minute or two, he knew that they were, because the opposite end of the narrow covered bridge was blocked. They were being herded into a cul-de-sac, and the tactical situation was changed, and their plan useless. There would be no field of fire from the side ports of the truck. The fight would have to be made entirely from front and rear. He said, "Keep going." They had to drive right into it. If they stopped short of the bridge and jumped out to make their fight at a distance, then the highwaymen could shoot and run. They had to get in close. Malachi kept going. "Sam, you and Bill take the ones in back," Randy said. "I'll help Malachi in front. Forget the sides." The Admiral and Bill crawled to the rear. Randy crouched behind Malachi's back. He checked the carbine. It was ready. He shifted an extra clip to his shirt pocket where it would be handiest. The block at the opposite end of the bridge was their Model A, its boxy profile unmistakable. A man waited at each bumper. You could ram the car, but you could not ram the men, so this tactic would do no good. Randy recognized them from Dan's description. The one with gorilla arms and the submachine gun stood at the front. The gun was a Thompson. The man with the bat was on the other side. He carried a holstered pistol, too, but from the way he hefted the bat, like a hitter eager to step to the plate, the bat was his weapon. Four men, then, instead of three. And no woman. Understandable. The personnel of these bands probably changed from day to day. "Right up to them," he told Malachi. "Close." The wheels hit the first planks of the bridge and Malachi slowed. Randy saw the muzzle of the Thompson rise. This was the one he had to get. He pushed the butt of the carbine into Bill McGovern's ribs. He said, "Let them come right up to you. Let them come right in with us if they want. We've got troubles up front." Bill nodded. The rhythmic timpani beat of tires on planks stopped. They were 20 feet from the Model A. The man with the bat advanced toward the left side of the truck. The Tommy gunner stayed where he was. In his light, Randy doubted that they could see anything in the truck body, but he did not stir. He was immobile as a sack. He whispered, "Make the son of a bitch with the gun come to us. Make him move. Make him come." The man with the bat was 3 feet from Malachi and 5 feet from the carbine's muzzle. If he looked into the truck cab, Randy would have to shoot him, and in that case, the Tommy gunner might get them all. There was nothing more Randy could say or do. He could not even whisper. It was all up to Malachi now. The man whacked his bat viciously against the door.
"What you got in there, boy?"
"I ain't got nothing, boss," Malachi whined. From the set of his right shoulder, Randy knew Malachi had his right hand on the .45, but he was acting dumb and talking dumb, which was the way to do. The Tommy gunner moved a step closer and two steps right so he could observe Malachi. He said, "Come on, Casey, get that dingy out of there." The man with the bat said,
"Step down, you black bastard."
Randy knew that the man couldn't use the bat while Malachi stayed in the truck, and he prayed Malachi would wait him out. He watched the gunner. "Please, God, make him take one more step so I won't have to try through the windshield." A shot through the windshield was almost certain to miss because of light refraction or bullet deflection. It would be foolhardy and desperate, and he would not do it. The gunner said, "Drag him out or blow him out, I don't care which." Malachi cringed and cried,
"Please, boss."
The fear in his voice was real. The man with the bat put his hand on the door handle. At the instant he turned it, Malachi uncoiled, hurling himself through the door and on him, pistol clubbed. The gunner took two quick steps and the Thompson jerked and spoke. The gunner's thick middle was in Randy's sights and he squeezed the trigger and again before the Thompson's muzzle came down and the gunner folded and began to fall. When he was on his face, he still twitched and held the gun and tried to swing it up, and Randy shot at him again, carefully, through the head. He had not even heard the shotguns, but when Randy crawled over into the front seat and got out looking for another target, the battle was over. Close behind the truck, two figures lay, their arms and legs twisted in death's awkward signature. The admiral stood over the man who had held the bat, his shotgun a foot from his head. Malachi was curled up as if in sleep, his head against the left front tire. It had lasted not more than 7 seconds. Malachi choked and groaned, and Randy dropped to his knees beside him and straightened him and lifted his head. Malachi choked again, and Randy turned Malachi's head so the blood could run out of his mouth and not down his windpipe. He tore open Malachi's shirt. There was a hole, large as a dime, just under the solar plexus. In this round well, dark blood rose and ebbed rhythmically, a small, ominous tide. The admiral said, "Shall I get rid of this scum?" Randy said, "Just a minute." He picked up the bat and forced himself to think ahead. First, Malachi. Get Malachi home in a hurry so Dan could do something if there was anything to be done. Dan didn't have his tools or much eyesight. He might make do with one eye if he had the tools these men had stolen. Randy ran to the Model A. It was empty. The doctor's bag wasn't there. He walked back to the truck where Sam Hazard stood over their captive. One side of the man's face was scraped raw. Malachi's plunge had carried the long-jawed, twisted-mouthed face along the bridge planking. "Where's the doctor's bag?" The man said nothing. Randy saw his right hand moving. He still had a holstered weapon. Randy tapped him on the nose with the bat. "Keep your hand still." The admiral leaned over, unbuckled the holster, and took the weapon. A .38 police special. "Talk," Randy said. The man said,
"I don't know nothing."
Randy tapped his face with the bat harder. The man screamed. Randy said, "Where's the black bag?" The man said,
"She took it. Rum Dum took it."
"Where is she?"
"I don't know. She goofed off with somebody last night. Maybe it was the